whatever his character is, or his actions prior to those police gunning him down is no one's business. It doesn't, that's not justification. That's not a permit to kill him. I don't care if he was a criminal, or as they say, a criminal or whatever. I don't care about, none of that matters. What matters is how those officers came with lethal force around a corner on a vandalism call after my son and gunned him down when he had nothing but a cell phone in his hand.
Reaction from Stephon Clark's mom to the announcement over the weekend that the Sacramento police officers who shot and killed him will not face criminal charges. Well, now California's attorney general has to decide whether to indict. This shooting has put a new focus on two pieces of legislation in Sacramento aimed at curbing police shootings. One is backed by police. It would require more police training on the use of deadly force. We'll hear more about that one in just a moment. First, though, we're going to talk about the other bill. It's backed by civil rights groups, and it was introduced by San Diego Assemblywoman Shirley Weber. She joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Well, tell us what's in your bill.
The bill itself is a fairly simple bill, and it's a bill probably that most people think is a policy of reasonable folks, and that says that a lethal force should not be used unless the officer's life is in danger or someone in that immediate community is in danger of harm, being harmed. And as a result, that's when you use lethal force.
So as you know, the determination was made in the Sacramento killing that the officers believed their lives were in danger, and that's why they opened fire.
Right. And there were a number of things that people look at the situation that were really available to them at that time. You know, when you take into consideration the totality of the situation, one, they were called to the scene because they believed the person was doing vandalism, that they were breaking windows in somebody's car. Now, I don't know, in most cases, vandalism is not a reason to kill a person because all they're doing is destruction of property. That's number one. Additionally, there was no one, the officers' lives weren't threatened because they weren't even around the house facing the individual at the time. And at the same time, there was no one else in the backyard but the gentleman himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were other things that could have been used. And this is why we say that you use other methods to de-escalate the situation. You had a helicopter above that could have provided some guidance and assistance. Additional lighting could have talked from the helicopter to bring situations under control. So bottom line is there were other means available. And as a result, that's why we say you should not use lethal force unless you are in danger as an officer of being harmed or someone in that immediate community is in danger of being harmed.
So you think the decision was a bad decision not to indict?
Well, of course it was, and it was an unfortunate situation for the family. The family did not need to have to hear all of the stuff that the district attorney tried to put a case together to assassinate the character and personality of Stephon Clark,
mm-hmm.
to talk about what he had said to his girlfriend 2-3 days before, all that kind of stuff. That was not why they were there. That they didn't come because they thought somebody, that they had a record of Stephon Clark, they thought he was going to be violent or something of that nature. So to go back and try to construct a case against him was unfair. And I think most importantly, you know, the district attorney could have stuck to what their ruling was without actually trying to assassinate the character of Stephon Clark.
The current legal standard is the reasonable standard, right? So that's basically justifying deadly force whenever a reasonable officer in the same circumstance would do the same thing. This is from really based on a 1989 U.S. Supreme Court case. So do you want to change that standard?
We want to change it to a necessary.
So it would be from reasonable to necessary.
Right. What is necessary to bring the situation under control? And is it necessary to use lethal force to save someone's life?
And do you anticipate that this might draw a legal challenge, given that the current law is based on a 1989 Supreme Court case?
You know, we have probably in this building, in the state, we've not had almost any bill passed that someone didn't challenge, especially if you're talking about a powerful organization like the police. Every bill that we put together, someone wants to challenge the legality of it or the practicality of it or whatever it may be. So our assumption is that probably will be a challenge, but it's still worth talking about a different policy for policing. And we've seen this happen in Seattle where, you know, there has not been an increase in the number of officers being harmed and there's been a decrease in people being killed. And that's the goal. The goal is to respect and to save lives. And that's what this bill hopes to do.
So there's this competing bill by Ana Caballero, a state senator from Salinas, also a Democrat, backed by law enforcement.
Right. This is the law enforcement's bill. The law enforcement is asking for a whole lot of money because they always want more money to do whatever training that's there, but they don't want accountability for the behavior of officers. So this bill has no content in it that says this is what they must do. The only thing it says is they must write a policy themselves. And that's generally what law enforcement likes. They like to write their own policy. That's why we have much confusion in the state about when do you use body cameras or not use body cameras. Why? Because every department writes its own policy and does not have to vet it through any agency other than themselves.
All right. Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right, let's talk about the other bill. This one is backed by law enforcement, and this bill was introduced by State Senator Ana Caballero. She's from Salinas. She's a Democrat. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right, tell us about this competing bill and why you have introduced it.
The bill is designed to reduce the number of use of force incidents in the state of California. And the focus of the bill is on police training and very clear guidelines. If the bill was adopted as it's written today, we would have the most comprehensive requirement that every police agency adopt guidelines in a whole different host of areas with public accountability.
Would they adopt their own guidelines, or would there be uniformity throughout the state?
There would be uniformity.
So each police department doesn't come up with its own ideas?
No, that's correct.
Okay. And then there would be presumably more accountability than exists now? Is that the idea?
Absolutely.
And what does that look like?
Well, there are new duties that require that if officers see another officer using excess force, that they are to report it. There's a requirement that the superiors investigate every incident and that there be a process for doing that, prompt internal reporting. There's a requirement that they all receive standardized training through the state. So everybody would go through this training, every 500-plus agencies, all their officers would have to go through this training that focuses on de-escalation and alternative methods of getting cooperation.
So this aims to prevent police shootings.
That's correct.
So is there an accountability part of it after a police shooting?
Accountability afterwards is still the same, which is that the district attorneys make the decision as to, you know, whether the use of force was appropriate or not. We're in the process of thinking that through to see whether there's an alternate way to assure the public that there are other eyes that are looking at the facts to determine whether the shooting was necessary or not.
Now, Assemblywoman Weber has proposed, as I'm sure you're well aware, in her bill to change the definition of justifiable use of deadly force. So instead of saying it is justifiable if the police officer has a reasonable fear for his life or her life, and change that word to necessary. Is it necessary to use deadly force? What do you make of that wording change, and what do you think of her bill?
Well, you know what? I believe that if necessary is a word that we're going to look at, we're going to have to add a whole heck of a lot more definitions as to what we mean by necessary so that officers, because what we do is we ask officers to respond to incidents that people feel have gotten out of control already. They are called when there's a domestic violence dispute. They are called when someone is acting in a violent way. And what we want to do is set a standard so that they can understand what their duty is and how they can continue to protect themselves and the public once they're called and they're confronted with an individual that does not want to cooperate.
Right. And then often in a split second having to make a very important decision,
decision. And particularly in instances where individuals may be under the influence of drugs or other substances, and their ability to reason and to be reasonable is difficult. So we're asking police officers to...
Well, I guess the difference between reasonable and necessary, from what I can understand, because they are both pretty vague terms, is that using the word necessary would hold the officer to perhaps a higher standard for using deadly force. because necessary is a little more narrow than reasonable, right?
Yeah, there's an argument to be made, but I think that the question becomes, you know, how do you define necessary? And what are the factors that you have to consider in order to believe that it's necessary to be able to use force?
All right. State Senator Ana Caballero from Salinas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Maybe you heard. Probably didn't. There's a special election tomorrow. It's for a seat on the LA Unified School Board. And by the way, LA Unified, the second largest school district in the nation. This seat is considered a swing vote on lots of hot button issues, such as charter schools. It could determine the fate of charter schools in the district for years to come. It is a crowded field. There are 10 candidates running. Jenny Hamill has been covering the story for KCRW. She's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
10 candidates.
Yeah.
This is for Ref Rodriguez's seat.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that background.
Right. So Ref Rodriguez held this seat. He was found guilty of money laundering. So in the summer of last year, he vacated that seat. Now, what was interesting about Ref is the reason he was installed in the first place, 2017, the most expensive school board race in the country's history, about $15 million poured
in. The country?
Yeah.
Wow.
$15 million poured in, 10 on the charter side, about $5 million from unions. Three seats were up for grab. So Ref is one of the individuals who's placed on the board, and suddenly you have a charter school backing majority. So Ref, along with that majority, made kind of what is known as the most controversial move. They voted in Austin Buettner as superintendent. And as you know, for people who are pro-union, against privatization, they, you know, call him a corporate reformer and, you know, playing into the hands of people like Eli Broad. So,
Right. And so that all came to the fore during the latest strike.
That's right.
So that has elevated this election too, right? The strike and all the attention that brought?
Yeah. I mean, the strike also high profile, a national story. Now you've got what's going on in Oakland or just, you know, concluded. And very much the tension within that strike, the theme that kind of is carrying through into this race is, again, the tension between privatization and the survival, this existential battle of will public schools survive and can they get the resources they need? Now, certain candidates are very, I mean, I would say all the candidates are very aware of that. But there are certain people who are really riding that wave and trying to get traction because of the strike success, especially on the part of United Teachers Los Angeles, the teachers union.
So okay. The teachers union has endorsed Jackie Goldberg.
That's right.
She's the front runner in this.
And to be very candid, from everyone who's watching, she is considered the one to beat. You know, she was very... She positioned herself well during the strike, was very vocal, and is really screaming out against the proliferation of charters. I spoke to her after a campaign forum. Here's what she had to say.
Right now, the board has three candidates bought and paid for by the charter schools. Their focus is on 20% of the kids. I'm not saying that people who put their kids in charter schools are making a wrong decision, but I think board members need to worry about 100% of the kids, not 20% of the kids.
Okay, so she seems to be campaigning explicitly as anti-charter?
Yeah, she's the one who's most vocal and critical of charterers.
And she's been a longtime state lawmaker.
Yeah, liberal icon, assemblywoman, represented District 5 as a board member for a while. So she's got a lot of name recognition and street cred, to be honest with you.
Okay, who else is in the running?
So Heather Repenning, she worked for Mayor Garcetti and now has his endorsement, which has led to other endorsements like SEIU Local 99, which represents a lot of education workers like bus drivers. They've poured a bunch of money into this campaign. She is the top fundraiser, a district parent. So she is considered someone who has got a strong running in the race. And then there's another woman who would probably be characterized as the most charter supporting of the candidates. That's Allison Barjaracharya. She's a district parent. She was a former charter school exec until she stepped down to enter the race. She's not saying like, hey, look at me, I'm all about the charters, but she's kind of being seen as the one who would most likely to get that kind of endorsement.
Is she getting the kind of money that Ref Rodriguez got in the last election from the charter organizations?
Well, she's gotten about $225,000. So when you compare a total of $15 million that was put in to the 2017 races collectively, I mean, it's not touching that yet. But we'll see what happens after the primary if she moves on.
Okay. The LA Times endorsed Cynthia Gonzalez. Tell us about her.
So Cynthia Gonzalez, I spent some time with her last week canvassing. She is raising no money. I mean, she maybe like $30,000. It's a very grassroots campaign. She was very excited to get this endorsement because the LA Times, her father had delivered the paper for 30 years and suddenly to see her name in print. But she was excited because she said she essentially didn't have much traction, but was recognized for her merit. She was born and raised in the southeast portion of District 5. She's a principal in the area. Her kids go to those schools. She says she is a product of lived experience as opposed to being someone who's an observer into the problems that exist for a lot of the kids in the southeast portion of District 5.
I think some people will say that the message might not be inclusive enough of all of the families in the Northeast, but we're in a state where we need someone to being able to speak to the needs of kids of color in this district. These needs here are extreme.
Right, and this is a majority-minority city, a majority-minority district for sure. Tell us more about the demographics of this particular district, because it is pretty split.
So what's interesting is that although a lot of the students come from the southeast, a lot of the high propensity voters and people who might actually sway this election come from the Northeast, places like Silver Lake, Los Feliz. You know, they're more white, affluent. Some are older. Some can vote, don't even have kids in the district, but again, have that voting power.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's a big get out the vote drive, lots of mailers being sent.
Yeah, if you live in the district, especially in the Northeast, you're being bombarded with these like beautiful flyers that I'm sure did not cost nothing to you live in the district.
I'm
you
getting tons of them.
That's right.
In my mailbox.
Yeah.
Tons and tons and tons.
So definitely there's some people with some power behind them.
Right. All right. So the vote is tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
10 candidates on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if no one gets a clear majority?
Yeah, and that's very likely. So if one candidate doesn't receive more than 50% of the vote, then the two top vote earners will move on to the runoff in mid-May, May 14th.
All right. KCRW's Jenny Hamill, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, why a local judge said a violent motorcycle gang has a right to its logo, even though it's been convicted of racketeering. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Donald Trump says he's going to sign an executive order to protect free speech rights on college campuses. He talked about it over the weekend during his rambling two-hour speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference.
If they want our dollars and we give it to them by the billions, they've got to allow people like Hayden and many other great young people and old people to speak. Free speech.
The Hayden he refers to is Hayden Williams, a conservative activist who was punched in the face last month while recruiting students at UC Berkeley. We're going to talk about this with Jessica Levinson, our legal eagle. She's here every Monday. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hey there.
Hi there.
Okay, so basically Trump wants to withhold federal funds from colleges if they don't protect the viewpoints of speech that students don't really like or if they do like, regardless of the political viewpoint. Can he actually do that?
Maybe not, because nothing says free speech like the government reaching into an educational institution and saying, no, that's enough free speech. Oh, and actually, no, that's not quite enough free speech. So you don't get your federal funds. So what I would say here is the devil is in the details, and we have no details. I have the sense that this is something that President Trump proposed as he was saying it, because his aides have essentially said, we have no comment, which I think might mean we didn't know about this.
So this issue has reared its head in the past 2 years, because remember the name Milo Yiannopoulos? Remember that guy? So he would show up on college campuses like Berkeley, and then the campuses would fear that there would be some actual political violence, and they would try to, you know, cancel the speech or restrict it in some way. What is the legal line there between safety and free speech?
Well, and this is a question that the Supreme Court has frankly been answering for decades now, which is the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, but it doesn't actually mean no law. So as you said, for instance, if you're in imminent danger, then we allow people to make laws. If you scream, here's the proverbial example, fire in a crowded theater, the government might be able to say, you don't get to do that. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, if you invite somebody to a college campus or to a university, and you truly have an imminent fear of physical violence, that can be a basis for saying, we don't believe that you should come. Now,
it can also be an excuse to say, don't come, we think there's going to be violence when there might not be.
Exactly. So there's basically two kind of questions here. One is there a real threat of violence? And two, what can the federal government force a university or a college, for instance, to do in terms of having speakers and or not having speakers? So the First Amendment protects your right to speak, but it also protects your right not to speak. So it protects you against forced speech. And what President Trump, in essence, is kind of doing to these universities is basically saying, we are forcing you to speak via having certain guests, via having certain panelists, having certain speakers. And if you don't, you don't get your federal funding, which is another way, frankly, I think that this is can be viewed as a form of censorship.
Well, that's also interesting when you consider the history of activism on the other side, on the left, and there have been, you know, attempts by governments, universities to deny permits or restrict access to groups like Black Lives Matter, for example, or any other group like that, that they fear would bring violence. And so that is also a free speech issue, too.
Absolutely. And if you think about like the demonstrations that happens after Charlottesville, one of the ways where you have to look and say, is the government doing its job or is it trying to censor us, is in this form of exactly what you said, permits, basically telling people, sure, you can come and speak, but not at this place or not at this time. But what President Trump is proposing here, I don't think is that kind of nuanced approach to looking at how do we deal with the competing interests of a diversity of views at university campuses, and also a university, or in some cases, a state or locality's desire to keep their residents or their students safe. This is basically just a blunt force object, which I frankly think is trying to scare universities into ensuring that they have more conservative speakers.
Okay, let's turn to another story in the news, one that you've been following quite closely. A judge ruled that the notorious motorcycle group, the Mongols, will actually get to keep its trademarked logo. That's a big blow to prosecutors who've been trying to seize that. It's like a Genghis Khan-like logo because they say it engenders violence. So tell us more about that. Why did the judge overturn that?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating case because federal prosecutors brought this claim contending that the Mongols had engaged in murder, attempted murder, RICO violations. And what they did is they actually brought the case against the organization itself. So they had previously tried to sue individual members of the Mongols. In this case, they got smart. They sued the whole organization. They say, you hold the trademark. And once we find you to be guilty, then under federal forfeiture laws, you have to forfeit not just ammunition, not just any illegal drugs, but also your right to this trademark. This is a novel theory. It's unusual. I'm not aware of this ever happening before. And the jury said, yes, you are guilty of these RICO claims, attempted murder, et cetera, drug dealing. And then in a separate case, the jury said, and because of that, the federal government gets to take your trademark away. Judge Carter in Santa Ana overturned that second part of the jury verdict and said, no, you don't. That would violate the First Amendment and it would violate the Eighth Amendment against excessive fines. And so what Judge Carter basically said is, even if you engage in bad behavior, even if this is a symbol of hate, you, government, do not get to strip a symbol because by virtue of that, it's symbolic speech. So essentially what the court said is we might not like speech sometimes, but that's actually the type of speech that we have to protect.
That's really fascinating. So, for instance, if you had a neo-Nazi group which used a swastika as its symbol, it could I mean, that's obviously a symbol of violence and hate. Is it similar to what the prosecutors tried to do here?
Yes, and actually this brings up a really interesting point. There is going to be a case that's argued in front of the Supreme Court this term that deals with what you can trademark. So my understanding is that under federal trademark laws now, you cannot trademark something, for instance, like a swastika and or something that's obscene. And then the case that's going before the court in, I believe, April, there was a company that tried to trademark a phrase that I'm not going to say on radio. And the idea is whether or not that is actually censorship for the trademark office to say, here's what you do and don't get to trademark. But in terms of your analogy of could the federal government try and take away the swastika, that is basically what was going on here.
Are prosecutors going to appeal?
Yes. I think if you look at what the prosecutor said, this is a case that seems destined for the Ninth Circuit. And if they'll take it, the Supreme Court as well.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, face tattoos and mumble rap.
They're almost blurring the lines between influencers and musicians in that their Instagram personas are equally as important as their musical skills.
Social media has created a new generation of rap stars. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Monday, so that means it's time to talk about music on the show. Today, let's talk about streaming social media stars who are changing the hip-hop industry. Exhibit A, Lil Pump. He has 880 million views on his hit Gucci Gang. That's basically the equivalent of the population of China. Gucci gang, 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 Gucci gang. Spread their racks on new chain. My blood dude. Ooh, I forgot name. When that song came out, Lil Pump was 18 years old. He had braces. In the video, he's got a lot of face tattoos and he wears pink and green dreadlocks. He is what is known as a SoundCloud rapper. Other big names, XXXTentacion, Juice WRLD, Tekashi 6ix9ine. Their outlandish looks, their over-the-top behavior, it's all made for Instagram. They have won legions of fans, and they've created a lucrative renaissance in the rap industry. But there's a dark side. 6ix9ine is in jail. XXXTentacion was murdered last year. So how does this new generation of rappers differ from those that come before? Carrie Batten interviewed many of them for her story in GQ this month. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Great, thanks. All right, Carrie, what exactly is SoundCloud rap?
So SoundCloud rap, the definition of SoundCloud rap has changed over the years. Now it's sort of a catch-all, and I think a lot of rappers are actually sort of rejecting that label because they don't necessarily want to be associated with it. But if you take it back to the beginning, SoundCloud rap is literally, some rap that was created by, you know, some young kids, a lot of them from South Florida, who would make DIY rap at home and upload them onto SoundCloud, where they would generate these huge fan bases. And sonically and stylistically, it's rap that's very unfinished, very unpolished, has a very low production value, often intentionally distorted. The lyrics are intentionally indiscernible, and it's the sound is very hypnotic and visceral, but it's not something that you would necessarily listen to for its lyrical qualities.
That's a really nice way of putting it. Okay.
Yeah. People like to describe it also as sort of rap's punk movement, and they make super lo-fi, often very short rap songs that usually clock in at under 2 or 3 minutes, and many of them have incredibly low production values as well. That's a signature.
Meaning they don't sound good to the trained ear?
Yeah, they might not sound good to the trained ear. I think in my piece, I interviewed an entertainment lawyer who represents both XXXTentacion and 6ix9ine, and he sort of expressed his amazement at hearing the original XXX hit called Look at Me. He said, "This isn't mixed. I don't understand. This song is not mixed." And X said, "Well, yes, that's the point."
Okay, let's hear. Look at me.
Son, where'd you find this?
Yeah. Okay, so it sounds overmodulated to my ear, and again, not mixed. It was made on an iPhone, though, right?
I don't know if it was made on an iPhone or if it was made on a laptop, but it certainly sounds like it was made on an iPhone.
Yeah. Okay, so the point being that it's raw, the energy. What are they actually rapping about? Anything meaningful, or is it just whatever?
It's often difficult to tell whether or not they're rapping about anything meaningful. Another characterization that has become widespread is the term mumble rap, which is synonymous with SoundCloud rap. And you'll hear that in the sounds where it's hard to make out the lyrics. It's hard to make out the chorus or if there is any overarching message. But, you know, usually it's just sort of like a guttural chant of a chorus with, you know, interjections about, you know, hanging out with your friends or sleeping with girls or taking Xanax.
So Xanax is the drug of choice.
Xanax is the drug of choice. The rapper Lil Pump, I believe it was for one of his birthdays or for some milestone in his life, he was gifted a giant cake in the shape of a Xanax bar, which, you know, it's a troubling side of this movement, especially because it's really hard to tell, you know, who's kind of playing it up for dramatic effect or who is actually seriously being plagued by prescription pill addiction.
So this, as I said earlier, this music isn't just irreverent. There's a real dark side to it.
Right. There is a real dark side to it. It's not all fun and games. And one thing that's interesting about this movement is all of these young rappers are predominantly men, and they're way more nihilistic and sort of downtrodden and way more interested in exploring dark emotions than I think a lot of rappers were in the past.
All right, so to that point, let's hear another song. This one's called Lucid Dreams by Juice WRLD.
I have these lucid dreams where I can't move a thing, thinking of you in my bed. You were my everything, thoughts of a wedding ring. Now I'm just better off dead.
Okay, so that song has had over 300 million hits as of now. And how is it that they use social media to become these huge stars, these rappers?
Well, I mean, I think rap has always been a genre that's been very digitally savvy. But these rappers in particular they're almost blurring the lines between influencers and musicians in that, you know, their Instagram personas are equally as important as their musical skills. And they have a fondness for going on Instagram Live and live streaming themselves. And I mean, they're constantly commenting in each other's Instagrams. They're communicating through emojis. I think last year there was a big fight among Travis Scott, who is not technically a SoundCloud rapper, but he sort of operates on the fringes. He's much bigger than a lot of them and more mainstream. But there was a fight over who sort of had ownership over the butterfly emoji between him and a rapper named Playboi Carti. And if you would compare that to, say, like a, you know, a traditional sense of what a rap beef is, it seems very absurdist.
Yeah.
But they've really leaned into it.
Well, as for real or just as a PR stunt?
I think it was real. That's another thing, is a lot of it seems like, you know, professional wrestling, in that so many of these wars and hijinks seem played up for dramatic effect, and it's very hard to tell who's being earnest and who's just trying to channel attention. But I think in this case, the butterfly emoji beef was real. It was almost too ridiculous to be fictitious.
This was really ridiculous. Who won, just out of curiosity?
I don't know, but I would say that Travis Scott won, just in terms of his the level of of success he's achieved in his career.
Okay, let's talk about someone else who's achieved a level of success that kind of blows the mind. 6'9", so he's called that or whatever. I don't know if this is why he's called that, but he has 69 tattooed on his body 200 times. Mm-hmm. And he has one on his face.
Yes, or I think he might have several on his face.
Okay.
And he has, you know, his signature is rainbow colored hair, and he also has a grill in his mouth that's rainbow colored. So he's really, he's almost like a caricature of SoundCloud rap. Although I would say stylistically, his music differs from a lot of his peers in that it's very gritty New York street rap sound. Whereas, as we heard from Juice WRLD, that tends more towards the melodic pop mm-hmm. side of things.
Okay, so let's take a listen with him and Nicki Minaj and their hit Fifi.
He trying to 69 like Tekashi, call him Papi, worth the ASAP, keep me rocky. I'm from New York, so I'm cocky. Say he.
Okay, that's another one that has a staggering amount of views, like 600 million or more. He, though, mm-hmm. is now sitting in prison, right? He's accused of some serious crimes.
Yeah, he's in federal prison now on charges of racketeering and gang activity for his affiliations with a kind of subset of the Bloods in New York.
Mm. Okay, so stepping back from all of this, these rappers have really, really invigorated the rap industry. What was happening before they came along, and how have they invigorated it and made it into something really hot?
So, I mean, I think the rise of streaming is sort of what has been responsible for all of this. I believe I said in my piece it was 2010 that rap made up under 10% of all album sales, and now that number has increased greatly, and now rap has become the most culturally dominant genre in America. And at the same time, streaming has overtaken physical album listening. And basically that opened up a path for these young people who are really good at cultivating fan bases online to sort of take over, and people who are very nimble using social media and using streaming services to be able to reach audiences very quickly, especially super, super young audiences. The way that I see it is that labels eventually caught on, and they said, okay, everybody's listening to rap. If you look at all of the charts, the top songs are rap, and so we are going to change our focus, and we're going to work on signing as many of these young rap stars as we possibly can. And it's almost become something like day trading. Someone had said that rap now, the game of A&R in the music industry almost resembles, you know, the teams who send basketball scouts out to like elementary school games to sniff out talent super early. Like the thirst for young rap talent is at an extreme level right now.
So these are by the major labels, this thirst?
Yeah, it's by the major labels. But yeah, part of the reason why SoundCloud rap is no longer a valid term is because oftentimes these labels are forced to act so quickly that a song can't even blow up on SoundCloud anymore before the labels snap them up and distribute their music through more official channels.
Okay, so now that it's become mainstream, what's the next thing that's not mainstream that we're going to be talking about in a year or two? Or do you think this is around for a while?
I think this is, one thing that's interesting is We saw kind of a major tipping point this past summer with Kanye West and Nicki Minaj, who are sort of two of the biggest old school heavy hitters in rap, and they both solicited features and collaborations with SoundCloud rappers, and those were sort of the only reasons why their albums got big streaming numbers or how they were able to retain a foothold in the mainstream. So I think you right now the SoundCloud rappers are really holding all the chips. I think there's a lot of talk about rap continuing to lean into its sort of, you know, rock, punk, and alt-rock fascination. A lot of these kids, one thing that's interesting is they don't cite rappers as their heroes. They cite emo bands like Fall Out Boy or Marilyn Manson or pop punk bands like Blink-182 as their biggest influences. And I think we're going to see a lot more young stars continuing to blur those lines between rap and rock until it becomes this sort of mush pile where we don't know what's what.
I already don't know what's what. So
right.
I want to thank you for, illuminating this and telling us what's what, because, wow, this is fast and confusing.
It is. It's incredibly fast.
Carrie Batten read about SoundCloud rap in the current issue of GQ, so go check that out. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, we'll remember the actor Luke Perry. He died today. He was 52 years old. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Actor Luke Perry died today after suffering a stroke last week. He was 52 years old. You probably know him best from his 90210 days in the 1990s. He played Shannon Doherty's brooding boyfriend.
Look, do you want to take a walk on the beach or something?
Oh, yeah, check out the homeless people. That'd be great.
Dylan, I don't know what happened up
That's
there.
That's right, you don't.
If you'd let me finish.
Excuse me, I have a knack for interrupting things.
Dylan.
I'm real good at interrupting things, and I've had just about enough noise for one night, okay?
Well, more recently, Luke Perry played a dad, Fred Andrews, on the drama Riverdale. Here to talk about Perry and his legacy is Michael Schneider, senior editor at Variety and host of KCRW's Screen Grab. Hey there.
Hey there.
Okay, you interviewed him over the last few years, right, a couple times. What was your impression of him?
You know, a really good guy. There's a lot of mensches in Hollywood, but mm-hmm. he was one of them. Someone who was very generous with his time, both with reporters, but also with fans as well. And I think he really appreciated the fact that, you know, Dylan McKay was a role that he was forever going to be identified with. And so he embraced that. And luckily, he had enough of a career beyond 90210 that he was able to appreciate playing that role over the years. But also appreciate some of the other things that he got to do since then.
Yeah, so he kind of made it a James Dean kind of role, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was, you know, he was the bad boy, right?
Yeah.
And the kind of character that we all wanted to be growing up. I was in high school when that show started, and
had a huge impact on the culture, right?
Huge impact, especially on Gen X viewers. But now with Riverdale, whole new generation of fans, younger fans who are watching that show on the CW and on Netflix, really appreciated him as well.
So was he sort of was it a nod, a wink to the fact that he was playing a dad when he was playing a teen heartthrob with similar teen stars who had aged into that more
exactly
mature
exactly
role.
He had moved on to the next level, but I think he still appreciated it and appreciated being in the public eye. And over the years he managed to do a lot of different interesting roles. He was on Oz, which talk about such a whiplash for someone who was a teen heartthrob to then play a gritty reverend character on that show. He did a lot of interesting things over the years.
Right. Well, talk a little bit more. Go back to 90210 because why did that hit in such a big way? Why did it touch a nerve, and what was his place in it?
Yeah, it was a combination of things. It was the right show at the right time for that generation of teenagers and young adults. It was the early 90s, and there hadn't been a show like that on for a couple of years. So the young generation, Gen Xers at the time, sort of embraced it as sort of their show. It was their teenage idols, and so you saw Luke Perry and Jason Priestley on pinups in magazines in lockers across America. So it was really that generation's version of the teen idol. And it was a show that was on the right network. It was on Fox, which mm-hmm. was a young, burgeoning network that was becoming big with young people with The Simpsons and In Living Color, and that show fit in just perfectly. So, again, sort of right time, right network, right show with these good-looking young people all together doing fun things in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, I mean, there's something else about that, too, the wealth. Also, can we be honest, they didn't really look like high school teens.
Well, that
was a lot older.
That was always the knock on Luke Perry, and, of course, in in the time old tradition of Hollywood. Of course, remember Grease, where I think John Travolta was like 30 when he played a high school student. Luke Perry was pushing 30 as well when he played Dylan McKay on 90210. But yet we suspended reality and enjoyed the show, and especially those sideburns. He brought back the sideburn.
Yeah, exactly. And then, okay, so then fast forward to Riverdale, and he's playing a totally different character.
Yeah, so he's playing Archie's father in the show, and got a lot of great nods for that as well. And this is a show that's a darker sort of, a different kind of teenage show. But again, sort of the same thing. It was the right show, the right time for that generation.
Okay, so Riverdale, what does it mean going forward with Luke Perry's death?
So that's the big question. Production has halted on the show, and they haven't really addressed yet how they're going to have to handle this moving forward. Obviously, they will have to address the character. The other big question is, Fox just announced last week that they're doing a reboot of Beverly Hills 90210. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, Luke Perry wasn't going to be involved, and it was a very different kind of show in that the actors from the show, including Jason Priestley, Tori Spelling, some of the others from back in the day, were going to play versions of themselves, heightened versions of themselves, and in a very meta move, it was going to be about them as actors trying to get the gang back together and put on a new 90210. Now, the big question is going to be, obviously, you kind of have to address Luke Perry's death, and maybe it becomes a very different kind of show going forward.
Yeah, but he wasn't going to be a part of it.
He wasn't. He had left Dylan McKay behind. He also, there was another 90210 reboot in the 2000s that he opted not to be a part of, because he said Aaron Spelling had passed on, and he didn't want to be a part of a show without Aaron Spelling's involvement.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
All my best to his family, obviously. Yeah. And it's a really, really sad day for fans of Luke Perry, of 90210, of Riverdale, of all the work that he's done over the years.
And also so shocking, only 52.
Yeah. So young.
Okay. Thank you. Michael Schneider, senior editor at Variety and host of KCRW's Screen Grab, remembering Luke Perry, who died today at the age of 52 after suffering a stroke last week. Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. Hi there.
Hey there. Well, yes, the three top trending topics on Twitter today, Luke Perry, and then 90210, and then Dylan McKay. So, and I've been just going through the Twitterverse, and it's in all kinds of languages. I see, people writing in Cyrillic and, a lot of Spanish and all kinds of tweets coming, I think, from all over the world. Like, he was not just, 90210 was not just a U.S. phenomenon. It was
not
kind of an international phenomenon.
Yeah. Were you a fan of the show?
I can't say that I was particularly a fan of the show. Like, I didn't really watch the show. It actually coincided with around the time that I started moving here to L.A. That show was happening right a little before that.
So you thought, this is what L.A. is like.
So I was like, yeah, that's right.
Where's the peach pit?
This is what I have to look forward to. So Katrina Patchett tweeted, "Today we say goodbye to a 90s icon, my first celebrity crush, R.I.P. Luke Perry." Kif Scholl says, "I'd become a fan of his watching Riverdale. So tragic, too young and too sudden." Frost Barnes said, "By all accounts, Luke Perry was a very decent, kind man. To die at such a young age should remind us all to tell those who matter to us how much they mean and how much we love them. Rest in peace." Yoram Pohl writes, "Working as a dancer for a long time, my stage name, Dylan, was taken from Luke Perry. Hmm. The absolutely coolest guy ever and an obsession with 90210. And Julie Pleck writes, "Luke Perry was one of the nicest, most genuine, loveliest people I have met working in this town. He was kind and vibrant and full of stories that he loved to share. He was a beautiful being, and this is a sad, sad day." So lots of people out there remembering Luke Perry in various stages of his professional life, I guess, but particularly 90210.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you very much, sure. Christian Bordahl. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.